I want to introduce our first speaker is Dr. David Polio. He's actually a longtime member of the Caucus on Homelessness. I love pointing that out when that's the case. He's at the University of Alabama. He's the Hillcrest Endowed Professor at the School of Social Work there.
And actually, I like to say this because it makes me feel really old. This is actually my 21st year presenting, and I think about 95% of those are with the Homeless Caucus. So, I feel like I just started an AA meeting. Hi, my name is David Polio, and I'm a homelessness researcher. Say hi, David. Actually, what I want to do, I'm actually a little nervous, not because I'm talking to y'all today, but because the people who did most of the work of the study are in the audience. And so I'm really nervous because that means if I don't quite get it right, they're going to stand up and help me get it right. So I want to completely acknowledge both our community partner, Andrea Stella at the Space at Tompkins, who's been a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful partner now for 3 years, 4 years, something like that. We met at Columbia, and they brought me down to look at what they do at Tompkins Square Park, and it's amazing what kind of a community action group happens. And so I really want to acknowledge that absolutely none of this research and the subsequent research we're going to talk about could have taken place, and I'm absolutely tickled that you made the long ride up to see this talk and scared to death. And my other co-presenter in the audience, Dr. Jennifer McClendon, who has been, we've been working together for longer than she's willing to admit, who is the focus group co-facilitator, along with James Thatcher and Andrea. And so we've been working together in this area for quite a few years and several studies. So they're there. The analysis comes from listening and analysis, but the nuances will be very interesting. I'm hoping when we ask questions, we can encourage them to kind of contribute their ideas. And also Eric Rice, who's here and unfortunately presenting at exactly the same time. I would recommend going to see his stuff. I'm going to talk about it quite a bit today as well, because his work and Dr. Karen Irit-Garg, who's also in the audience, are folks who've been working on technology now for several years. See if this, I can get this to move forward. Okay, how about that one? What happens is, and we'll start by thinking about the population, and one of the things that kind of emerges in the literature is that young adult homeless, which here we're going to define loosely as 18 to 25, have extremely high rates of risk behaviors for HIV. Lots of sex work and drug use, a substantial proportion of which include needles. And so they are at very high risk of HIV, but they actually don't have particularly high rates. So we can anticipate that, given the risk behavior patterns, that they're very likely to have later on high rates of actually having HIV. So they are an optimal population for prevention efforts. And that's kind of the gateway into this discussion, although I hope later on this will inspire other ideas for how to reach this population. Because one of the things that anyone who's done research with any homeless population, runaway, any of the marginalized populations that we see in this country and that there are many sessions on, is we know that these populations are very difficult to reach. They are usually mobile, they are often suspicious, and if you get into and read some of the qualitative literature, you can see that their suspicion is not based outside of relatively good reality testing. So they're difficult to engage, they're difficult even to find, and what we need to do is think about how do we reach them. So what happens is, and this is some research that's recently published, but we've had around for a little year, few years, is one of the things that we found is that the use of technology in this population has been found to be relatively pervasive. And I hope one of our later presenters is not going to shake his head at this. He just did. Keith McGinnis just did a review of this area, but we find that it's relatively pervasive. So this data, which is collected at in both Los Angeles and New York, suggests that this data is Denver, Los Angeles, and I've forgotten the third city. I think it is New York, actually. St. Louis was later. This is from a 5-city study, and we realized as we were moving into the study quite accidentally, and I've told this story a dozen times. We were in Austin, and we're doing a respondent-driven sampling, and we asked our first interview to refer us to someone who they felt would be willing to talk to us, and this is 2005, and they pulled out a laptop. And that's the genesis of my interest in technology, because I had two simultaneous responses. One is, oh my God, I'm old, and the one that is more generative to this audience is, oh, technology. Gee, I hadn't thought of that. That's probably, as a professor of social work, I would say that's probably a response based on my privilege. And what we did was we went out and added it to this 5-city study, which we've presented here several times, and asked, do you use technology, and if so, how often? And what we found was that virtually all of them in our 3 cities use technology at least weekly, and almost half are on it every day. And that it's not that, you know, counting the zeros in, they're using technology more days than they're not. And this was our first kind of foray into this, and we came to the conclusion that this is a real opportunity, and also a fact that when we think, and like I said, I'm feeling a little radical this morning, when we think of this population, we tend to not think of their competencies and strengths, and this is kind of an indication that there are more strengths and opportunities than perhaps we would realize, or I don't want to speak for you, than perhaps I'd realized. And so we asked the next question, which, where are they gaining access? And a lot of it, and this data is actually a few years old, but it seems to reflect in some ways, and this is more anecdotal than anything else, it seems to reflect a trend that is ongoing, that most of the access is through phones. And remember, I said this is 2005, and I think the data is 2005-2007, with the advent of better and better smartphones and cities like Los Angeles having dollar-a-day plans, it's probably more than it was then. So we took a look with a second data set, and this is New York and Los Angeles, and these are agency young adult homeless, and we compared their use, and this is just the social network data, of social networks. And we found, and this is a publication in a computer and psychology journal, we found that the differences were there were fewer differences, that they looked more like undergraduates than they didn't. And we concluded and argued that the digital divide may be more of a cohort effect. So this gets us, this was our first qualitative, and all this is really up here is to kind of give voice to the population. That this is from a series of focus groups from a paper that we're finishing. I think my authors would say about damn time. Just to kind of give you a feel for what they said to us when we asked them. So that leads us to where we are. And this works very nicely with Eric Rice and his colleagues' work around technology. And what they found was that they also found something very, very similar and asked the young adults a question that we hadn't, is, would you get on? Would you use it for treatment or services? And in a series of articles that are listed below, they came to the conclusion that, yes, this is a means of reaching this population. And as I said, Eric is a co-investigator on the study, and we're all the future research is pretty much the same group. So what we did was we decided what we really wanted to do was find out more about the youth. And what we took was, this is not traditional grounded theory. We're actually trying to use a grounded theory approach to understand how to reach this population. Because one of the things that we'll get at is, you know, how do we get them to our social networks? So what we did was a series of three focus groups run by my colleagues, and also with James Thatcher, who's the software developer of a website used by the Tompkins Square Park group. And so we had a provider, a focus group facilitator, a trained focus group facilitator, and a software person. So the idea was to ask the youth themselves. So we asked the young adults, did a group, kind of tried to figure out what we'd learn from it, did a second group, got them to expand and to add to it, and then did a third group with a small group to see what they could add. And at that point, we felt that we had reached an initial reasonable saturation point, so that we were not getting anything radically new in the third group. Also, so you know, some of the participants, particularly in the third group, had also been in previous groups. So some were new, some were naive. So we got a mix so that we could kind of capture all of the pieces. So the first question was, why not just set up a Facebook page? That was not the question, but that was kind of the thought in our mind. And what happens is, and these are quotes from the focus groups, and what we found was a couple of things that are kind of worth highlighting. And one is they would rather kind of a local approach and something that fits what they do and what they experience a little better. And in one sense, part of that is, I've hit the button too early. I think my next slide is the point I'm about to make, so I apologize if I'm correct, is that there's a lack of trust of the large social networks, which, as a Facebook user myself, I didn't find particularly surprising. I don't really trust Facebook either. But the idea is putting it on an existing social network felt that it was too exposed, that people would record what they said, et cetera, and that's, again, based kind of in pretty good reality testing. So these are features that came out of the groups themselves, and these come from transcriptions, and basically everything that they said and expanded on is on this list. And there's some things that are interesting in how you look at this list, because it really breaks into two or three conceptual pieces. And this is, the analysis is ongoing, so I'm kind of telling you where what we're seeing in this, and my presenters are actually hearing this for the first time, is some of this is really about instrumental. Some of it is, where do I get stuff, where do I get services, etc. Some of this is social. How do I meet my friends? Things that are very present-centered and located kind of conceptually, spatially around the Tompkins Square Park area. And the third, which is very intriguing to us, and we'll talk about how this impacts in a second, is how do I maintain contact? How is this part of a community? And so the features are kind of, I don't think they're surprising. I will note that I promised I wouldn't do that, so I am. I do not list pornography on here, although it did come up repeatedly. I didn't see that that was a feature that we were going to be incorporating in any website development. Although, again, from the standpoint of reaching young adults, it's, you know, it doesn't violate face validity particularly strongly, or at least not my memory of it. Here it is. I told you I had the slides out of order. The other thing that happened was the feeling that, and this is really important, is that this is a community. They want it to be controlled. Not anyone can get on it. And while some of that is about suspicion about people trying to infiltrate and victimize, what's really interesting is the concept of community that emerges very consistently. They want people to be known, which in the homelessness literature is a construct that's been around for, oh gosh, 50, 60, 70 years now, is the idea that you are known. I was thinking about Tally's Corner. Perfect. So the idea that this should have some sponsorship. You should be known, you should behave, etc. And I think that's very important. And this I'll say very quickly in passing. The other thing is, we heard this in a couple of places, where when they leave the area, because this is New York, and as a southerner, I would say New York gets way too cold for human beings to live in, but I would say the same for Boston after the last two nights, is they want to be able to check back in. And even if they leave the area, they'd still like to have the virtual connection. And this is really interesting. And if people are curious, we can talk some more about social networks, because we also collected about 100 social networks as part of this study that we haven't analyzed. So here's kind of the summing it up, and I've made all of these points. So where do we go? And the two pieces, the first is we now know enough, we think, to create a network. And the idea is, and this is a grant that's currently under review, is to develop this website and use it as a means to see if we can deliver HIV prevention services. So the idea is they come, they join, all of the features are there, all of the local stuff, and opportunities for education and link-throughs to, in this case, we're looking at the, I think it's the CDC HIV Young Adult Prevention, so that we can deliver this message. Now, methodologically, this is very challenging, and I'm not going to talk a lot about it, in part because I'm dying to see what the review committee has to say about it, but the idea is tracking them online and their behavior, and this will be done with their permission, looking at the click-throughs and for the local sites, whether they are actually going when they click through. We have a comparison group idea, using the public website and propensity score matching to create a sample matched on a couple of features. And then we're going to try and look at some of the self-reported risk behaviors to see if this happens over time. And we also, because I'm traditionally a mixed methodologist, we are going to use the blogs and the feedback on the website as qualitative data. And that's it.